Hello there, this is Barbara Markland. This week we studied the beautiful Psalm 91, written by Moses while the Israelites were in the wilderness. As many psalms do, this psalm changes tense. We begin in verse 1 with third person. Verse 2, the writer switches to first person. Verse 3, we're back to third person. And then when we get to the last three verses, 14 through 16, it reverts again to first person, but this time it's God speaking. We're learning so many beautiful names for God. This psalm has four names for God in the very beginning. He who dwells in the shelter of the Most High, that's El Elyon, the high and lofty God, will rest in the shadow of the Almighty, that's El Shaddai, the immovable mountain. I will say of the Lord, that's Adonai, He is my refuge and my fortress, my God, that's Elohim. Let me say at the outset, the key to this beautiful psalm is found in verse 1. He who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will rest in the shadow of the Almighty. The blessings mentioned in this psalm belong to those who are in God's house. There's a big difference between visiting God on Sunday, spending an hour and a half in praise and worship, offering a quick blessing before the meals the rest of the week, and maybe an arrow prayer every now and then. Lord, this is a big meeting. I need your help. There's a big difference between that and living in the presence of God. God in your thoughts, in your words, in your actions, every moment of every day. These blessings are not available to the casual believer. The promise is that when you live your life focused on God, with God as the center, these blessings, this is what your life will look like. And that's what we want. Verse 1 uses the word dwell or maybe abide. It's the sense of continual living, remaining, abiding in the presence of God. Where is the presence of God? For Moses' Old Testament readers, they would have recognized immediately he was referring to God's tent, the tabernacle in the wilderness. God invited the Israelites to build him a tent in the middle of their city of tents, 2.5 million people living in the wilderness in tents. And the Israelites were commanded to build a tent for God, and that God would dwell in the heart of his people in the midst of this city of tents. And of course, the spiritual significance is that one day Jesus would come and dwell literally in the hearts of his people. This tent in the wilderness was 45 feet long by 15 feet wide by 15 feet high, and it was divided into two rooms. The front room was 30 feet long by 15 feet wide, two-thirds of the area. They called it the holy place. Inside that front room, the holy place, one-time holy, holy place, was the menorah, the only light, the table with 12 loaves of bread on it, a golden altar of incense, and a curtain that separated the front from the back. The curtain was embroidered with angels. This was to remind the Israelites that when Adam and Eve sinned in the garden and they were evicted, God put the angel with the flaming sword there to say, your sin has separated you from God. You are no longer allowed into God's presence. That curtain was to symbolize that that was as far as they could go in God's house. On the other side of that curtain, in the area that was left, which was 15 feet long, 15 feet wide, and 15 feet high, a perfect cube, that was where God dwelled. That was called the two times holy, the holy, holy place, or the most holy place. Only one piece of furnishing in the holy, holy place. It was the Ark of the Covenant with the lid that was called the mercy seat. One time a year, the high priest was allowed to go beyond that curtain and pour blood out on that mercy seat. All of it points to Jesus. The significance and all the details, everything's fine gold. Every detail pointed to Jesus. This was a wonderful gift from God that the Israelites had a place that they could come and make an offering and find forgiveness for their sins. And the wonder was that every tent, 2.5 million people, every tent could see God's tent because that Shekinah cloud of glory that showed that God's presence was there rested upon that tent. And the message was clear. When you lived in the presence of God, Blessings flowed over you. I have a wonderful quote from you from Charles Spurgeon. Listen to this. Every child of God looks toward the inner sanctuary and the mercy seat, yet all do not dwell there in the most holy place. The shadow of the Almighty is an expression which implies great nearness, We must walk very close to a companion if we would have his shadow fall on us. There are four verses in the Bible that mention the shadow of the Almighty. They might help us to understand exactly what this means. The first example is Isaiah 32, verse 2, where it's described as the shadow of a great rock in a thirsty land. This implies refreshment. It also can imply victory. Remember as a child how we all loved to climb up on the mountain, "I'm the king of the world." Refreshment in the presence of God. The second is Song of Songs, chapter 2, verse 3. Under the shadow of the apple tree. When you think of an apple tree, what do you think of? Shade, rest, perhaps sweet aroma from the blossoms, and a picnic, a place to spend quiet time with God, in the presence of God. It could even make us think of communion, a place to have a meal with God. The next is Psalm 63, verse 7. The shadow to sing under the shadow of the wings of God. To sing. Sing implies joy, contentment. What about those wings? Perhaps the wings could imply the ability to escape trouble, flight. The last is Isaiah 49, verse 2, to hide under the shadow of his hand. God is a tender father. He's also a mighty warrior. So it would be both ends of the spectrum, the tender hand of God guiding and directing his child, and the strong hand of a warrior capable of protecting that child and everything that's found in between in the presence of God. After writing that beautiful first verse, Moses switches to first person and he describes God as my God in whom I trust. I hope you call God my God. Let's look at some people in the Bible who also called God my God. Ruth, remember Ruth said to Naomi, "Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God." It's personal. The next is Miriam, the sister of Moses. After the tremendous rescue and the Israelites find themselves on the other side of the Red Sea, their enemy has been defeated. They have a praise service. Miriam leads them in singing and dancing and lifting their hands to the Lord. I think they praised until they were so exhausted they dropped over. Miriam said to God, "You are my God, not our God for the whole nation." No, it was personal. You are my God. Jesus himself said that in Matthew 27, 46. My God, why have you forsaken me? It was very personal to Jesus. And the last one is Doubting Thomas. Jesus said to him, "Put your hands in my wounds, touch them. Stop doubting and believe." And what did Thomas say? What any of us would have said. My Lord and my God. Now we revert back to third person again, and Moses is talking to his readers. But I want you to understand, in Hebrew, there are two different words for you. There is a singular you, and there is a plural you. Unlike English, we just have one word, and we don't know whether it's singular or plural. Psalm 91 is written to the singular you. The whole psalm is personal. Verse 3 is interesting, isn't it? "Surely he will save you from the fowler's snare." What does that mean? The fowler is the person who hunts wild fowl. Moses doesn't go into all of the tactics, but I want to because this is what he's telling the Israelites and us. Satan uses the same tactics a fowler uses, and Moses is saying God will rescue you from that. Satan sneaks around in secret, hunting God's children, sets traps for God's children, entices them closer with a decoy. It's fake. It mimics the real, just like Satan mimics God, twists his word. So we wind up saying, is that what God said? And Satan entices God's children with pleasures, and then the trap falls on them. That's exactly what a fowler does. Moses is saying when you are in God's presence, God will protect you from Satan's tactics. The verse also says that God will save us from deadly pestilence. God does rescue us. He is the great physician. But these verses are not all-inclusive. It doesn't mean we will never get sick. We will never get cancer. I found a thought-provoking story that's a great example for this verse. Back in the 1600s, the plague was ravaging the city of London. And this gentleman named Lord Craven, who was a Christian nobleman, wanted to escape the city, as all his friends were doing, to get out into their homes in the country. So he told his servants, "Get the coach ready. We're leaving. We're going out into the country." As he was descending the grand staircase in his home, he heard one of his servants say to the other, I guess his God lives only in the country. That phrase stopped Lord Craven in his tracks, and he thought, no, my God lives everywhere. What kind of an example am I setting for my servants, for my family? He told the servants, unpack the coach, we're not going anywhere. Not only did he stay in the city, but he devoted his time to helping those in the city who were dying with the plague. He never got the plague. What an example he was. My God lives everywhere. So does yours. Verse 4, such a beautiful verse. We know that Jesus quoted this, and we'll talk about that later. He will cover you with his feathers, and under his wings you will find refuge. This is a wonderful picture of a mother eagle, the blend of tenderness and great power. God deals with us the way a mother eagle deals with her eaglets. Covered with those feathers, under those mighty wings, we find protection from the storm, from the trials, from our enemy. Let's look at when Jesus quoted this verse. It's found in Matthew 23, verse 37. It's called the Seven Woes. This was probably Monday or Tuesday of Passion Week. 3 days later, Jesus would be dead. It was the last public encounter that he had with the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. Seven times he said to them, woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. And he told them what they were doing wrong and implored them to do right, to believe in him, but they wouldn't. At the end, Jesus says, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem. Remember, anytime it's repeated twice in the Bible, it's for extra emphasis. How I have longed to gather you as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. Jerusalem was unwilling to dwell in the shelter of the Most High, and instead they crucified Jesus. What a picture of the heart of God longing to rescue us. The last part of verse 4 says, his faithfulness will be your shield and rampart. We don't have any worries about God's faithfulness, do we? It's our faithfulness we have to worry about. What does this mean, the shield and rampart? It could also be translated as the shield and buckler. It's defensive armor. The shield was small and often round. It would be held in the hand and constantly moved to protect any arrows coming at you. The buckler was armor wrapped all around the body to protect you on your sides, to be your rear guard. Between the two, your body was protected. Some commentaries see that the shield as the truth and the buckler as the power of God. Wrapped in God's power, we have no reason to fear, do we? Verse 5 and 6 tells us exactly that. This reminds me of the Deuteronomy verse that we looked at last week, where it said to impress your children, when you stand up, when you sit down, when you go in, when you go out, all the time. This has the same idea. You don't have to be afraid of terrors at night, arrows in the daytime, pestilence in the darkness, or plagues in the midday, which is the brightest part of the day. We don't have to be afraid. If only we could really take that to heart. Listen to this verse from Charles Spurgeon. Not to be afraid is an unspeakable blessing. For every suffering we endure from a real injury, we torment ourselves by 1,000 griefs arising from our fear only. Isn't that the case? How many nights have we laid awake, unable to sleep, afraid of something that never happened? Now again, this verse is not meant to be all-inclusive. We do have trials and troubles in our lives. Just ask Job. Just ask Jesus. But every trial has to come through the hand of God first. And God is more powerful than every trial. Verses 7 and 8 are fun verses, aren't they? 1,000 may fall at your side, 10,000 at your right hand, but it will not come near you. What a great reminder that God is stronger than Satan and any of our trials. 10,000 to 1. Remember, 10,000 to them was an uncountable number. Revelation says there is 10,000 times 10,000 angels in heaven. It just means we can't count how many. The message is clear. When we dwell in the shadow of God, we can really trust God. I thought it might help us if we look at three examples of people who did trust God, and we can be encouraged by them. The first is George Mueller. He lived in Bristol, England, and in 1849, he started an orphan house. He wanted people to know this: God can be trusted with the practical affairs of life. He put God to the test, so to speak. He started this orphan house with no money of his own and asked only God for help. He never asked for anything from anyone else. Soon he had more orphans than he could fit in his house, so he asked God for money to build an orphan house. God provided everything he needed, and he built an orphan house for 300 children. I want to tell you about one particular day, and I'm going to tell you in story form. The house mother of the orphan house informed George Mueller, "The children are dressed and ready for school, but there is no food for them to eat." George asked her to take the 300 children into the dining room and have them sit at the tables. He thanked God for the food and waited. George knew God would provide food for the children as he always did. Within minutes, a baker knocked on the door. "Last night I could not sleep. Somehow I knew that you would need bread this morning. I got up and baked 3 batches for you. I will bring it in." Soon there was another knock at the door. It was the milkman. His cart had broken down right in front of the orphan house. The milk would spoil by the time the wheel was fixed. He asked George if he could please use some free milk. George smiled as the milkman brought in 10 large cans of milk, just enough for 300 thirsty children. How much trust in God does it take to sit those children down, sit with them, and wait on God? George Mueller was passionate for God to be glorified and for his children to see it is not a vain thing to trust in God. In verse 11, Moses says, "For he will command his angels concerning you to guard you in all your ways." Remember, this is the singular you. This seems to infer that we don't get just one guardian angel, we get multiple angels. Mighty created beings commissioned by God to protect us. Do you ever wonder, what is out there that we can't see? If only we could see what is around us. Would you like to see what is around us? Turn in your Bibles to 2 Kings chapter 6. Elisha, the prophet of God, and his servant are trapped in a house. The king of Aram has surrounded the house, and he's out to get God's servant Elisha. Verse 15, "When the servant of the man of God," Elisha is the man of God, "got up and went out early the next morning, an army with horses and chariots had surrounded the city." "Oh, my lord, what shall we do?" the servant asked. "Don't be afraid," the prophet answered. "Those who are with us are more than those who are with them." And Elisha prayed, "O Lord, open his eyes so he may see." Then the Lord opened the servant's eyes, and he looked and saw the hills full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. God does protect his own. I imagine if we could truly see what God is doing with these mighty angels, we would not be afraid. The second example I want you to see is Charles Spurgeon himself. Psalm 91, verse 9 is part of his personal testimony. It's 1854. The plague is ravaging the city of London. He's a young pastor, and he said that he was weary in body and heart from 12 to 15 funerals a day, watching children die. He says, "My burden was heavier than I could bear, and I was ready to sink under it. As God would have it, I was returning mournfully home from a funeral, when my curiosity led me to read a paper, which was wafered up in a shoemaker's window in the Dover Road. It did not look like a trade announcement, nor was it, for it bore in a good bold handwriting these words." The words are Psalm 91, verse 9, but it's written in the King James. It's a little harder to understand. "Because thou hast made the Lord, which is my refuge, even the Most High, thy habitation, there shall no evil befall thee, neither shall any plague come nigh thy dwelling." The effect upon my heart was immediate. Faith appropriated that passage to my heart. I felt secure, refreshed, girded with immortality. I went on with my visitations of the dying in a calm and peaceful spirit. I felt no fear of evil, and I suffered no harm. The providence, which is another Old Testament word for God, which moved that tradesman to place those verses in his window, I gratefully acknowledge. In the remembrance of God's marvelous power, I adore the Lord my God. When we dwell in the shelter of the Most High, He keeps these promises. We too can say that we adore my God. When we look at verse 13, "We will tread upon the lion and the cobra, the great lion and the serpent." I want to look at Jesus as our example there. Now, we know on the cross that Jesus did trample sin, Satan, and death, but he trampled Satan before that. Matthew chapter 4, verse 10, when Jesus is being tempted in the wilderness by Satan for 40 days, that snake, that serpent, Satan, insidiously tries to tempt Jesus to take the crown without the cross. Jesus responded by dwelling in the presence of the shelter of his Father, of the Most High. He uses the word of God, and he says to Satan in third person, worship the Lord your God only. But if Jesus had said that in first person, it would have been, I worship the Lord my God. Jesus trampled Satan by remaining in his Father's presence and using the word of God. Well, we've saved the best for last. We're at verse 14, and God speaks now. Verse 14 begins, because he loves me. You know, that also could be translated, because he cleaves to me. What does that make you think of? Back in the Garden of Genesis, God said the man would leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife. God said, because he cleaves to me in that closest of relationship. And then God lists out 8 I wills, 8 promises. Let's make them personal. I will rescue you. I will protect you because you acknowledge my name. I will answer you when you call. I will be with you. I will abide with you, dwell with you, remain with you. It's all the same word. I will be with you in trouble. I will deliver you. I will honor you. I will satisfy you. I love that one. No unfulfilled longings in God. I will satisfy you. And I will save you. Remember, Psalm 91 says, he who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will rest in the shadow of the Almighty. Do we just visit God on Sunday? Or do we dwell in the shadow of God every moment of every day? You can have as much of God as you want. And this psalm proves to us there is a lot to be had. How much do you want? That concludes the wonderful Psalm 91. Have a blessed week. I'll see you next time.